Grovelling apologies, Radio Derb listeners. Due to an unforeseeable concatenation of contingencies, we failed to broadcast last week. As well as being a dereliction of duty, this was a dangerously antisocial lapse, as thoughtful conservatives all over the world were left helpless, not knowing what to think about the week's events. They could only sit staring, glassy-eyed into space, hoping against hope that nobody would ask them the significance of the recent unrest in Bolivia, or the state of health of Thailand's King Bhumibol, or, if someone did ask them, falling into uncontrollable weeping. Our civilization ever teeters on the edge of a precipice, and only the constant vigilance of positive forces like Radio Derb prevents it from toppling into the abyss. We shall strive to be more diligent in fulfilling our responsibilities to National Review Online, to our listeners, to the United States, and to Western civilization. Now then, where were we? Where were we? Well, we were watching our president-elect put together his administration. Mrs. Clinton, I see, is to be our next Secretary of State, attempts to revivify Cyrus Vance apparently having failed, and Warren Christopher having refused to give up his place in the line for the shuffleboard court. Well, that's good news for us New Yorkers, as we may finally be rid of the pantsuit princess, who never seemed to like us much anyway. But I guess it's bad news for foreigners everywhere, as they'll have to put up with Hillary flying in to harangue them on gender equality, the vast right-wing conspiracies, and the correct way to dispose of inconvenient billing records. But hey, who cares about foreigners anyway? What we New Yorkers want to know is, who will our next governor appoint to replace the lady as our junior senator? Since we now live in a nation whose political life is as dominated by powerful baronial families as was Plantagenet England, it's natural to expect that Mrs. Clinton's replacement will be from the northeastern aristocracy. The Bushes are now definitely settled in their southern estates. The Jackson and Daley dynasties can't be separated from their patronage networks in Illinois, and the Romneys are in temporary eclipse following Mitt's failed presidential run. That basically leaves us with just Kennedys and Cuomos. That's it for local political barons, isn't it? What's that you say? Clintons? Come on, our governor is not going to name Bill Clinton to his wife's Senate seat. In fact, he's already said that he won't. So, who are you talking about here? Oh, no. Not Chelsea. No! The atrocity of the week was, of course, the terrorist attack on Bombay in India. And please don't give me this Mumbai flapdoodle. I'll start saying Mumbai when TV news anchors start saying Moskva, München, Roma and Firenze, Paris, Xiangang, Al-Kahira, Bali Ahaklia, and Kunung Tep. Well, here we are in Bombay, where at least 10 young Islamic fanatics murdered nearly 200 people last weekend. It was a typical Islamist raid, very much like 9/11, the kind of raid that pastoralist herding people have been conducting on settled farming people for the past 10,000 years or so. You're never going to reduce the level of this kind of thing to zero, but there's a lot of control you can exert. One, you can have your covert ops people keep chasing these little terrorist groups round and round the bushes so that they can't get too big or too threatening. Number two, they are fish who live in water. the water being populations of ordinary Muslims, almost all of whom are peace-loving and individually harmless people. If you let such populations develop in your own country, you're making life much easier for the terrorists. No Western country should permit large-scale settlement of Muslims. This option isn't open to India, which is stuck with 150 Muslim citizens. It's open to us, though. 3. Liberty. If you have a chronic terrorist problem in your country, citizens will demand surveillance, special measures, phone taps, and any number of other liberty-destroying measures. For maximum liberty within your country, you need to keep the terrorist fish and their water supply out of your country. Secure the borders. And once again, don't permit large-scale Muslim settlement. It's our country. We can let people in who we want. 4. You really, really don't want these guys to get a nuke. If you're observing my number one, there'll never be enough of them in one place to get manufacturing a bomb, so the peril comes from some sympathetic government handing one off to them. This is the big problem. Fix on this one. Don't let it happen. A hostile nation handing off nuke to crazy terrorists? No, no, no. Okay, now how will the Obama administration shape up on my 4 points? Number one, the relentless effort by covert ops. Well, with Eric Holder in charge, our covert ops guys will be spending most of their time huddled with their attorneys, so you can forget about that. Number two, stop Muslim settlement. Oh yes, right. President Barack Hussein Open Borders Obama will be sure to do that. Number three, liberty. Well, the right-left struggle is always fundamentally one of liberty versus equality. We just elected a leftist government, so liberty can go hang for 4 years while equality takes over. Number four, hostile governments handing off nukes to terrorists. Oh, but in the Obamaroid worldview, there are no hostile governments. There are only governments that we haven't talked to nicely enough. So I guess the Obama administration isn't on board with my program at all. Where did I put that sales brochure for fallout shelters? Schools all over the country are changing their names to Barack Obama School. High school, middle school, elementary school, whatever. But which schools are doing this? Well, a school in my neck of the woods just did it. Ludlam Elementary School, here on Long Island, will henceforth be Barack Obama Elementary School by a unanimous vote of the 5-member school board. Okay, off to greatschools.net to look up the statistics. The student body at Ludlam, now Obama, is 62% Hispanic, 36% African American, 2% other. Now, the school board undoubtedly has a right to name the school in any way they please. Is it unreasonable of me, though, to see this as yet another sad example of the resegregation of our society, another wedge driven into the widening crack that separates citizens below the elite levels, with white and Asian citizens on one side of the crack, blacks and Hispanics on the other side, ice people and sun people. Those student stats, which are by no means unusual, speak very eloquently to the quite thorough resegregation of our public schools in recent years. I predict, with no joy at all, that we shall soon have Obama school jokes to go with our Martin Luther King Boulevard jokes. You know those jokes. What do you do if your car breaks down on Martin Luther King Boulevard? Run! No non-Hispanic, white or Asian Americans live on Martin Luther King Boulevard. No non-Hispanic, white or Asian Americans name a child Deshaun or Tashika. No non-Hispanic, white or Asian Americans will want to attend a school named after our president-elect. One nation, indivisible? Well, it was a pleasant dream, I guess. Here's a little philosophical conundrum for you. Is a woman's virginity one of her essential qualities? It sounds like the topic of a treatise by some medieval scholastic philosopher, Duns Scotus or one of those dudes. But it was very much in play in a French court recently. You see, the French civil code allows a spouse to seek an annulment if the other party has misrepresented his or her essential qualities. Well, one of that nation's Muslim citizens, finding that his bride was not intact, and having perhaps recently read Tess of the D'Urbervilles in an Arabic translation, had been granted an annulment on these grounds. On appeal, however, the annulment was annulled, and the couple now have to seek a formal divorce. An oddity of this case was that neither husband nor wife were parties to the appeal. Prosecutors had gone ahead anyway on feminist grounds, arguing that the original annulment discriminated against women. You know, nobody's checking the guy's virginity. So, once again, the progressive infatuation with cultural minorities comes crashing up against the actual beliefs and customs of those minorities. Celebrate diversity. Meanwhile, as unemployment climbs up off the charts, opening up America's borders and flooding the country with $5 an hour high school dropouts who can't speak English is naturally a very high priority for the new administration. President-elect Obama has set up an immigration policy working group. Who's in it? Well, let's see. We have a chap named T. Alexander Aleinikoff, a professor of law at Georgetown University. Well, there's a red flag to begin with. Law professor at Georgetown University translates pretty directly as slightly to the left of Pol Pot. Everybody knows that. Professor Aleinikoff, it says here on Wikipedia, has been a senior associate at the Migration Policy Institute. There's another red flag. Anytime you see the word migration, you know you're dealing with open borders people. Migration, you see, is just people floating effortlessly and unobstructed from one place to another. Who but a snarling, hate-filled bigot could possibly object to that? Well, let's wiki this group, the Migration Policy Institute. Quote, a non-profit think tank dedicated to the study of the movement of people worldwide, funded by donations from numerous corporations, and multinational organizations, including the United Nations, the Carnegie Corporation, and the Ford Foundation. End quote. Oh, boy. The Ford Foundation. I'm running out of red flags here. Well, who else have we got on this immigration policy working group? Stanford University's Mariano Florentino Cuellar. Well, let's do a little googly on him. Oh, what's this? Under associations, Mr. Cuellar lists La Raza Lawyers Association of California. So, he's a paid-up member of The Race. Now, most Americans, every time we are polled, are opposed to high levels of immigration and strongly opposed to amnesty for illegal immigrants. Does our president-elect have anyone on his immigration policy working group to represent that point of view? The point of view of most ordinary Americans? Incidentally, speaking of the race, a full-time employee of the National Council of the Race has been named Obama's Director of Intergovernmental Affairs. That is a lady called Cecilia Munoz. The chair hombre of the race put out a statement praising Ms. Munoz's service to, quote, the Latino community. The statement assured us that, quote again, no one will work harder for her country and for the ideals and priorities of the Obama administration, end quote. Well, that's nice, but which country is her country? Perhaps someone should make it clear, as it's not at all clear from Ms. Munoz's professional activities. Government efforts to encourage mass illegal immigration aren't just restricted to the USA. Across the pond, in the land of my birth, illegal immigrants are elevated above ordinary citizens in rights and privileges, and any criticism of them, or of government policies to encourage them and coddle them, is regarded as literally and actually criminal. The latest person to discover this was Damian Green, the Conservative Party's chief immigration spokesman in the House of Commons. The Conservative Party is currently out of power in the sceptred isle, the Labour Party being the party of government. As the party of government, the Labourites of course feel justified in sicking the police on members of Parliament who commit gross violations of decency. That would be Mr. Green, who has been a strong critic of government policy towards illegals, and who has uncovered damaging evidence of government stupidity and venality in this regard. For example, 5,000 illegal immigrants somehow got through government checks and won jobs as security guards in public buildings in London. Mr. Green has been investigating other similar blunders in British immigration policy and trying to publicise them. Well, for this, he got his House of Commons office raided by the police and his computer seized. His London apartment was also raided, as was his permanent home down in Kent. Mr. Green himself was arrested by a police squad and had his cell phone and his BlackBerry confiscated. Yeah, that'll teach the bastard to toe the line on immigration policy. Anyone who objects to mass illegal immigration is a fascist and a bigot who deserves anything he gets. That's the rule in Britain. And that'll be the rule here under our new administration. The slogan is rising all over the Western world. Celebrate diversity, or else. This is a favourite of mine. I blogged about it on The Corner, but I can't resist recycling it. The headline here is Wudu. Wudu. I do, you do, he, she, or it do. We do, you do, they do. Wudu. Wudu is the Islamic cleansing ritual to prepare the worshipper for prayer. Wudu involves washing the face, hands, arms, and feet 3 times each, gargling the mouth 3 times, and washing the neck and the inside of the nose and the ears. Some Muslims also wash their private parts. Well, that's wudu. I have no problem with it. Let me make that clear. There's nothing wrong with a little hygiene. To make sure they're ready for prayer, Muslims are supposed to perform wudu after using the toilet or breaking wind, it says here. Derb, put down that sound effects CD and back away slowly. Okay. So far so good. Now, here come the Catholic bishops of England and Wales. That's Catholic as in Roman Catholic, as in Christian, as in Charles Martel, Richard Lionheart, and Don John of Austria. the Catholic bishops want Muslim prayer rooms to be opened in every Roman Catholic school in England and Wales. And they also want wudu facilities in their schools so that Muslim students in Catholic schools can observe the proprieties. Naturally, British Muslims are thrilled about this. They're already putting forward specs for the new facilities. Quote from a chuckling Muslim, quote, Catholic schools will need to install bidets, foot spas and hoses to facilitate the cleansing rituals, end quote. Thin end of the wedge, if you ask me. Wait till they start asking for stoning rooms. Just a few short items to see us out. Item. Never mind renaming schools, Perry County in central Alabama has gone one better. The county supervisor has declared that the second Monday in November will henceforth be Barack Obama Day, and county employees will have the day off. So, pretty soon you'll be able to walk down Barack Obama Boulevard, past Barack Obama School, on Barack Obama Day, perhaps looking to buy a set of Barack Obama commemorative chinaware. That's already gone on sale. I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, but shouldn't we wait till the guy's actually, like, you know, done something? Item. A cop in Boston, Massachusetts, issued a traffic ticket to a woman in labour who was being driven to the hospital by her husband. Not only did the cop issue a ticket, he made the woman wait while he finished filling out a ticket for another motorist. We're not told what shape the other motorist was in. Dying of a heart attack, possibly. Item. Zhou Xiaochuan, governor of the Chinese Central Bank, lectured Hank Paulson, our Treasury Secretary, in Peking the other day. Quote from Mr. Zhou. Overconsumption and a high reliance on credit is the cause of the U.S. financial crisis. As the largest and most important economy in the world, the U.S. should take the initiative to adjust its policies, raise its savings ratio appropriately, and reduce its trade and fiscal deficits. End quote. Interesting. Overconsumption, eh? But what are the things that we've been overconsuming? Don't they all come with Made in China labels? Perhaps Mr. Zhou should be careful what he wishes for. Item. Closer to home in Valley Stream here on Long Island, a store employee was trampled to death the day after Thanksgiving by a mob seeking bargains. This was one of those strange events that were discussed one way in the public prints and broadcasts, but in an utterly different way in private conversations. The theme of public commentators was, "What's happened to us?" Private citizens, talking among ourselves, responded in the manner of Tonto's reply to the Lone Ranger, in that joke everybody knows. What do you mean, us, Kemosabe? Item. Up there in the friendly giant to our north, some kind of constitutional crisis is going on. My producer over in the control booth is signalling that we're almost out of time, so I'm afraid I'll have to wrap it up here, listeners. I'm not going to let you go without a brief cultural note, though. Next Tuesday, December 9th, is the 400th anniversary of the birth of John Milton. In honour of the great poet, here is one of his best sonnets. It needs a few words of explanation. In 1656, when he was 47 years old and a widower and already blind, Milton married his second wife, Catherine Woodcock. A baby daughter was born in late 1657, but a few months later both mother and baby daughter unfortunately died. This poem is in memory of Catherine. The Alcestis that Milton mentions in line 2 was a lady in Greek mythology who was rescued from the underworld and returned to her husband, a chap named Admetus, by Heracles, son of Zeus, a.k.a. Jove. The old law that Milton mentions in line 6 is the one in Leviticus chapter 12, about a woman's purification after childbirth. Well, here's the sonnet. Methought I saw my late espoused saint, brought to me like Alcestis from the grave, whom Jove's great son to her glad husband gave, rescued from death by force, though pale and faint. Mine, as whom washed from spot of childbed taint, purification in the old law did save, and such, as yet once more I trust to have full sight of her in heaven without restraint, came vested all in white, pure as her mind. Her face was veiled, yet to my fancied sight, love, sweetness, goodness in her person shined, so clear as in no face with more delight. But oh, as to embrace me she inclined, I waked, she fled, and day brought back my night. There now, pure Milton. Like every great poem, that one has been parodied a lot. Dylan Thomas, whose wife was just as big a lush as he was, wrote one that started, "Methought I saw my late espoused saint passed out on the bathroom floor." You can't subtract from genius, though, and John Milton stands tall after 400 years, not just as a poet, but also as a fighter for liberty. Tuesday, December 9th. Take a little time off to read some Milton. You might want to listen to some Franz Josef Haydn as you do so.